Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscribe button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
Jesus says, if the world hates you, know that it hated me first, and that it hates you because it hates me. Well, we know that this is true. There are some different ways of reacting when we find ourselves at odds with the world. We're always at odds with the world. We don't always realize we're at odds with the world. But when Christianity is under assault, when Christians are under assault, when they are being mischaracterized in our culture, how do we react to that? Some fight back and some say, well, let me see if I can convince you that we Christians aren't what you think we are. Well, we're certainly not what they think we are, but playing against their stereotypes, how has that worked out for, say, evangelical elites? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to talk about evangelical elites, Dr. Carl Truman. He's professor of biblical and religious studies at Grove City College, a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and author of the new book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, and a recent column for First Things titled The Failure of Evangelical Elites. Dr. Truman, welcome back.
Great to be back. Thanks for having me.
You talk about two temptations that beset Christianity when it feels its place in society is under threat. What are those temptations?
Well, one temptation is to become very angry and shake one's fist. And I think we might look at American society at the moment and see some of the things that are going on what would be called the religious right, or maybe even the Christian nationalist right, as being emblematic of that kind of response. On the other hand, there are always those who attempt to try to find some sort of compromise with the regime change, if you like, within society that allows them to accommodate themselves to what's going on. And the danger there is we lose our Christian distinctiveness in giving away too much ground to the non-Christian world.
Who are the evangelical elites?
I'm using the term in the article really to refer to those who are extremely influential within the broad conservative Protestant world, who tend to position themselves positively relative to the mechanisms or instruments of cultural influence, the Atlantic Monthly, the New York Times, etc., etc., and who can tend to look down on the less well-educated foot soldiers in the Christian world.
Who was Friedrich Schleiermacher, and what was his solution to the Enlightenment's critiques of Orthodox Christianity in his day?
Schleiermacher was a brilliant theologian of the late 18th, early 19th century, often thought of as the father of modern Protestant liberalism. He was working at a time where the Enlightenment had really done a lot of damage to Christianity in terms of raising questions about the credibility of miracles, for example, raising questions about the credibility of the classical Trinitarian doctrine of God built upon what was seen to be an old-fashioned view of reality or metaphysics. And Schleiermacher wanted to reconstruct Christianity in a way that took the Enlightenment critique of traditional Christianity seriously, and yet somehow managed to preserve a place for the Christian language, Christian practice, those kind of things. So, to cut a long story short, what Schleiermacher essentially did was he redefined Christianity, not so much in terms of doctrine or dogma, in terms of truths out there about God, but in terms of religious feeling. That when we use doctrinal language, we think we're talking about a God out there, but what we're actually doing is describing our own religious feelings. And he felt that was a way of trying to salvage Christianity in a way that the Enlightenment would accept.
So how does his strategy, how does it differ or how is it similar to the evangelical elites?
Well, I think there are some fundamental differences. I mean, it would depend on which evangelical elite you are looking at. But in the article, I talk about the work of Mark Knoll and George Marsden relative to history and scholarship in higher education. And one of the things that, that Mark Knoll and George Marsden are both absolutely clear on is their thoroughgoing Orthodox Christian theology. And I think we would say that Schleiermacher really sells out Christian orthodoxy in his reconstruction of what Christianity is. Where the similarity would lie, though, I would argue, is that both Marsden and Knoll and Schleiermacher share a similar motivation, and that is they want Christianity to be respectable within the context of what we might call polite, sophisticated, cultured, educated society. So the similarity, if you like, might lie at the level perhaps of motivation, ambition, or aspiration at that point.
How were Knoll's and Marsden's attempts to help Christian re-enter the worlds of science and academia, how were they initially successful?
Well, I think what they did in the early 90s was they set forth a vision before evangelicals of a way of approaching the world and a way of approaching culture that took what I would describe as the canons of academic and scholarly discourse seriously. Mark Knoll, in his famous book, The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, made the case that a lot of the time evangelicalism is despised, not because it's Christian and evangelical, but because it's actually not very good. There isn't, I think he said, the scandal of the evangelical mind is there isn't much of an evangelical mind. That much of the scorn that in the 80s and 90s evangelicals experienced in what we would describe as the sort of the educated, cultured, sophisticated world was the result of the fact that they weren't actually very good scholars. And what Knoll and Marsden did was make a sterling clarion call for Christian academics to take academics and scholarship seriously and to do it well. And I think that was a call that was well-placed in the 90s and had a certain positive effect. It certainly was inspiring to somebody like myself to think, yeah, if I'm going to be a Christian scholar, I need to make sure that my scholarship is good scholarship.
Who is Francis Collins, and what does his rise to cultural acceptance tell us?
Francis Collins is a brilliant modern scientist. He's a professing evangelical. He was appointed head of the National Institute of Health by President Obama. And Collins, as a self-proclaimed evangelical, when he was appointed, for example, Christianity Today said that this was a major step forward. I think the New York Times or the Washington Post said that evangelicalism had come of age. You know, Collins was a good example of somebody who could profess evangelicalism, but also be an outstanding figure within his field, specifically a scientific field. And often, of course, people think there is a basic opposition between religious faith and science. And Collins demonstrated that was not the case. Unfortunately, during his tenure at the National Institute of Health, he didn't seem to make much of an impact on the issues that many Christians are concerned about. So the NIH continued to sponsor research on aborted embryonic material, i.e. aborted babies. More recently, the NIH was involved in a grant given for the experimentation on aborted materials that was racially profiled. So when Collins was appointed, there was great hope that an evangelical could make a huge difference in this particular area. In actual fact, I think it's arguable that Collins was ultimately only able to be the person he was because at key points, at the points where the culture clashed with his Christian faith, he conceded the faith in order to conform with the cultural expectations of his position.
You write, the problem with Knoll and Marsden's approach is that modern intellectual culture has never been engaged in a morally neutral exercise of refining the canons of intellectual inquiry and debate. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, the Knoll-Marsden project was very much predicated on the idea that the canons of scholarly discourse, the way of writing good scholarly work, is an exercise that Christians can engage in, the same as non-Christians. And we can be good at those canons and can therefore gain acceptance within the academy. Of course, that assumes that scholarly canons operate within a culture that is neutral towards the religious and the moral convictions we hold. Now, In the 90s, that might have been more plausible than it is today. But, for example, I think in his outrageous idea of Christian scholarship, George Marsden talks about you could be on faculty, this is in the 90s, with a gay colleague, treat them with respect and expect them to respect your scholarship. You conform to the canons of scholarly discourse that both you and your gay colleague would accept. I think today most people would acknowledge that if you're on faculty with a gay colleague, it's not going to be enough that your scholarship is good. You're going to have to affirm gay identity as a legitimate identity. That may be nothing to do with your scholarly work, nothing to do with canons of scholarly discourse, and everything to do with the terms of recognition, we might say the culture, the political culture of higher education. And that's why this idea that, well, we can get on in the academy by being good scholars has proved ultimately wrong-headed, because it's not enough to be a good scholar in higher education today. You also have to tick certain political boxes in order to find acceptance.
Dr. Carl Truman is our guest. We're talking about evangelical elites. When we come back, more broadly speaking, how have we Christians fundamentally misunderstood the Enlightenment's animus toward Christianity? In 1521, at the Diet of Worms, Martin Luther was asked to recant his writings. Luther responded, "Unless I am convinced from the sacred scriptures that I am in error, I cannot and will not recant. Here I stand, I cannot do otherwise. God help me. Amen." Will you stand with us as we proclaim these Reformation truths in the 21st century? You can take your stand by becoming a monthly or annual contributor to Issues Etc. Find out the benefits of becoming an Issues Etc. confessor, apologist, reformer, or patron on the Support Donate page at issuesetc.org. Click the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. Help us proclaim the solas of the Reformation: Scripture, faith, grace, and Christ alone. Here we stand, Issues Etc. and you.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming three-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR21. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
We're talking with Dr. Carl Truman about his First Things column, The Failure of Evangelical Elites. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're linked to Issues Etc. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's life ministry is devoted to upholding the sanctity of human life, both in our church body and in the culture at large. They've produced resources on topics like abortion, adoption, euthanasia, and more. You can download them for free at lcms.org/life, advocating for the unborn, weak, and vulnerable. LCMS Life Ministry, lcms.org/life. Dr. Truman, more broadly speaking, how have we Christians fundamentally misunderstood the Enlightenment's animus toward Christianity?
I think there's much of the way the story of the Enlightenment has been told has tended to focus on what philosophers call epistemology. In other words, how we know stuff. That is a big part of the Enlightenment. A big part of the Enlightenment is reflection upon what constitutes human knowledge, how we come to know things. But a second strand of the Enlightenment that has not been such a big part of the story we've told about the Enlightenment, but which is nonetheless still there, has been the Enlightenment was really a rebellion against God as well. And Nietzsche understood this in the 19th century when he declared that Enlightenment philosophers had killed God. What he meant was there's an anti-theist dimension to the Enlightenment that has been missed in the narratives. And I think when we see Enlightenment institutions like the university purely in epistemological terms and not in moral terms, we miss a significant part of that story, and we miss something that's going to create difficulty for Christians, and that is, it's not simply what we know intellectually, it's also what we believe morally that the Enlightenment is striking against.
And as you have pointed out elsewhere, this Enlightenment, especially as it manifests itself today, does not lack a moral code. It has its own moral code, one that is openly hostile toward Christian morality.
Absolutely. I think we're now in a situation where, for many years, the moral codes by which one would be accepted in broader society ran along roughly the same lines as Christian morality. Not entirely, but broadly speaking, that was the case. We're now in a situation where the moral terms of membership in society are increasingly directly opposed to traditional Christian morality. And that really means that you can be the greatest scholar you can be, but if you don't tick the boxes on certain moral issues, you are simply not going to make the grade. You're simply not going to be granted membership.
What did you learn recently teaching historical method to college students?
Well, we used George Marsden's book, The Outrageous Idea of Christian Scholarship. And what intrigued me about the students was how they couldn't get their heads round such what they regarded as a naive approach to acceptability within the academy, the one I outlined earlier with when I talked about the scenario with the gay colleague. And it's not that George Marsden's a naive person at all. It's just he was writing this 30 years ago. And in the last 30 years, the political culture of higher education has been transformed in a way that for a student in higher ed today, it is very, very difficult to imagine a world where the kind of moral issues that we're up against today were not a major part of what was going on.
You say that military rank and file evangelical support for Donald Trump was paradoxically a gift to the evangelical elites. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, but it goes back in some ways to that my answer to the first question was, you know, one of the responses to the feeling that we've been pushed the margins is to try to find common ground with the captains of culture, those who have their hands on the levers of cultural power. And I think one of the things that the Trumpite evangelicals did was they gave the elites an opportunity to be able to distance themselves from that kind of thing, be able to point, for example, to the January the 6th riots and say, that's not the kind of Christianity we represent. We are different. We are closer to you. We are closer to the cultural elites than we are to the rank and file engaging in that kind of behavior. And I think when you look at a lot of what I would describe as the punching down that has taken place in evangelical quarters from the never-Trumpers at the top to the rank and file below, that indicates that, yeah, the Trumpite faction have given the elites a good opportunity to distance themselves from the evangelicalism that they find somewhat embarrassing.
You say that post-Trump, the political landscape has certainly changed, but the game is the same. How so?
I think we still see the anti-Trump and the pro-Trump rhetoric playing out in some ways. You know, I wrote that article a few months ago. I'm perhaps not so sanguine that we're in a post-Trump world in terms of Trump vanishing as a particularly influential or divisive figure. We're in a post-Trump presidency world. But Trump remains this kind of litmus test for many on where you stand on the evangelical spectrum.
And do you think that the evangelical elites have, to some degree, had their illusions of cultural acceptability, if not destroyed, at least diminished with a Biden presidency?
You'd like to think so, but the rhetoric I'm seeing at the moment gives me no impression that that's the case. I think there still seems to be, if I put it bluntly, I think Trump so colonized the minds of some people on the right and some people on the left of the evangelical spectrum that it is very, very hard for people on the left at this point to look at the Biden presidency and take a proper assessment of what's going on. Maybe that will happen in the next 2 or 3 years, but I don't see any kind of disillusionment on the evangelical left at the moment relative to Biden.
How would you evaluate the evangelical elite's response to the pressing moral issues of our day?
I think they've tended to accent the ones that play well in wider society. Race, for example, would be perhaps the most obvious. And in many cases, though not in all, in many cases downplay or remain silent on the issues that I think are equally, if not more, problematic, and they would be matters of sexual identity and abortion. So I think there has been a certain mimicking of the wider world's liturgy on these issues that the evangelical elites have engaged in.
You say that Christianity tells the world what it does not wish to hear. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that Christianity, Jesus himself says, "My kingdom is not of this world." Jesus makes it very clear that Christians can expect to be hated in this world. When you look at the New Testament, I think the New Testament is clearly bringing, Jesus brings judgment against the world as we know it and the way we construct it. So whether you're on the left or the right, Jesus is not there to rubber stamp your political ideology. He's there, I might say, first and foremost, to stand in judgment on it. And I think that's something that seems to have been eclipsed in a lot of the recent discussions.
Dr. Carl Truman is professor of biblical and religious studies at Grove City College. He is a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and author of the new book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, and a recent column for First Things titled The Failure of Evangelical Elites. You can read this column and purchase The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Dr. Truman, thank you.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
In hour two of Issues Etc. on this Wednesday afternoon, it's day four of Issues Etc. Reformation Week. We're going to be talking about Lyman Stone's journey from Methodism to Lutheranism. He's author of a column for the Issues Etc. journal titled From Despair to the Real Presence of God. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Unshaken from Psalm 16:8 is the theme for the 44th academic year at Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois. We engage young adults in a Christ-centered environment, delivering academic excellence and encouraging spiritual growth. Please help us provide tuition assistance to more students by making a tax-deductible gift at melhs.org and click on the support page. Or call me, Dr. J. Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
The grace of God, the church's music, the Lord's Supper every service every Sunday, preaching Christ crucified and risen, our hope for years to come. There is hope in St. Louis, Hope Lutheran Church, that is, 5218 Neosho Street, St. Louis, Missouri. Find us on the web at hopelutheranstl.org.